Welcome to Minnesota Jazz Legends, The Elders. I'm your host, Patty Peterson. In Minnesota, we are very lucky to have many jazz musicians and singers who have performed for most of their lives, and some right into their 90s. It's always amazing to hear their stories, and in this show, we will hear from several legends from previously recorded interviews and live-in-the-studio performances. We will learn about their start in the jazz scene, their challenges, and finally, their continued passion for this art form. Our musical guests are familiar to many, and we hope by the end of this broadcast, you will feel as though you will all know them better. I invite you to sit back and listen to our Minnesota Jazz Legends. This show is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and KBEM. Well, it's time to move on into another performer who is in the Twin Cities and in Rochester, too. And his name is Les Fields. He has the Turkey River All-Stars. Les, thank you so much for being a part of our program. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for asking me.
Turkey River All-Stars has been around since when?
Well, depends on how you describe it. We first used the name Turkey River All-Stars in 1968. But I put together some little groups occasionally from 61 to 68. But when the name started.
Well, you had some music in your background growing up, and you got into college and you had an opportunity to play in college. And what happened?
Well, I went to Iowa University, and my goal was to get in the band and try to get on the golf team. And I got in the band, even though I kind of messed up the audition, but in the marching band, they need a lot of bodies. So I got in the marching band in the uniform and three football games. Then they had tryouts for the golf team, and I managed to get on that. They kept 12 guys, but I found out they both practiced at the same time. So I had to give up on it. That was very difficult. So I had to decide, but I picked golf. And
at that point, were you jobbing around when you were still living in Iowa, or did the desire to play, and you play piccolo cornet currently,
no,
right? Or
what? No, it's a pocket trumpet. It's actually a regular trumpet. It's just coiled up. It's just about half the length it would ordinarily be, but it's a regular trumpet. They had one band man for the whole high school, junior high, grade school. And the only lessons I had were group lessons with five little cornet players, few lessons. He must have had a sense of humor because he got me to play a solo in front of the high school band. And the name of the tune was Organ Grinder Swing.
Did you swing?
Well, I practiced, went home and practiced at noon and came back. And I said, you know, that starts out just like she'll be coming around the mountain. He said, oh, okay, well, Lester, come on, we got to go. So 8-bar introduction by the band, and I played She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain.
Were you playing music at all when you first came to Rochester?
Well, I played with a little band out of Independence called the Aristocrats. And then the Mayo Clinic had a big band, 22-piece band. They called the Notochords, which is a medical term, actually, but it sounds musical.
It sure does.
18 doctors and 4 of us peasants. And I didn't play in that for about 20 years.
Were you playing trumpet at the time?
Yeah. But they just practiced once a month and played somewhere once a month for free. And that was about in the early 60s. But I didn't really get going with the Turkey River All-Stars probably till 68.
Talk about that story, how it got started.
Okay. I was having coffee with Ben DeWitt. We call him the godfather of the band now. He was with the First National Bank, and he was saying he was in a jam because he just found out at the morning Thursday meeting that he was supposed to line up the band for the Christmas party 2 days away. that he couldn't find a band. They were all busy. So I just said, well, that's too bad. And then I got up to my office upstairs in the bank, and I thought, I bet I could round up some guys in a hurry. So I did. Called him back 20 minutes later, and I said, I think I got a band for you. And he said, well, good. What's the name of the band? I said, well, just you don't have a name. He says, well, okay, but you got to let me know first thing in the morning what the name of the band's going to be, because I got to put it in the program. So then I remembered an old cardboard orchestra front I'd painted 18 years before that in Cresco, Iowa, when we put together a band and played for the country club party, which was on the Turkey River. And I was going to have to use written music for that first job. The other guys just winged it. They were pros. And so I called Ben in the morning. I said, how'd it be for the Turkey River All-Stars? And he says, what? It sounds like a softball team. Incidentally, about 30 years later, I learned there was a softball team in Cresco back in 1906.
That was the birth of the Turkey River All-Stars.
Yeah, I guess you could call it that.
And so today, the Turkey River All-Stars continue on, and you've gone through some personnel changes. You've had some people who have been inducted into the National Banjo Hall of Fame. You've had some other awards and accolades, even yourself, right down to being inducted into the Minnesota Music Hall of Fame. And you have a story about that, too, because you don't like to do anything without mentioning your band name, and there was a little pushback on that.
Yeah, a couple of people nominated me, but they called about 50 people, I think, that all wrote letters. And they all nominated to be, you know, Les Fields and the Turkey River All-Stars. And a year later, I get a letter saying that I'm being inducted. I called them up and I said, what happened to the band? You know, I said, there's no way I would be inducted. I wasn't even a music major. And the band is what made it, you know. They said, well, that's the way they usually do it. They said, you wouldn't find the six fat Dutchman in there. It would be Harold Laffemacher. I'd still like to have the band named. So they took it up at the next monthly meeting, and they said, no, that's the way we do it. Anyway.
But what year was that? Anyway. That is very, very nice. And if you told me right, it's not only your name, but you've got a picture of the band, too, at the Hall of Fame in New Ulm. What year?
2007.
Great.
But Lowell Schreier, our banjo player from Mankato, he was inducted a couple of years before that to the Minnesota Music Hall of Fame and the National Banjo Hall of Fame. And then I mentioned Lowell's daughter, Debbie, who we met her when she was 7. She started playing with us when she was 19. And I'm not supposed to tell you how old she is now.
Okay. Well, we want to ask.
Anyway, she's going to be inducted into the National Banjo Hall of Fame this fall.
It's congratulations to her and to you and
Oklahoma.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
So, when you think back on your career, you've had a lot of highlights. Do you have one that sticks out in your mind?
Well, it'd be hard to pick on our CD that played here. It lists.
You've got a lot of highlights. I do know that. I mean, you've got the top 10, like David Letterman here.
We were lucky to make a connection with the Delta Queen, the Mississippi Queen. And we played 30 cruises over a 25-year period between St. Paul and Davenport. And we were the official Minnesota band at the 1984 World's Fair in New Orleans for a week. Oh, I got to tell you a story. That might be a highlight right there.
Okay, let's hear it.
We were there for a week. We played 2 or 3 concerts a day. And we flew down on Northwest Airlines. And we took an 11-piece band. Everybody wanted to go. Piano, drums, tuba, clarinet, trombone, trumpet, 4 banjos, piano player, and a second drummer. And up at 30,000, Dr. Denny Robertson, banjo player, he says, do you think they'd care if I played my banjo? And I said, well, don't ask him. He says, why? I said, they'd probably say no. So he started playing. Pretty soon all 4 banjo players were playing. We all had our instruments, except the piano player and the drummer. We played on and off all the way to New Orleans. And when we got off, there was an English doctor right ahead of me saying goodbye to the pilot. And he says, I say, is this quite common in America?
That had to be so fun.
And then the last day there, we we had our own Bourbon Street Parade. That's a famous tune. And so all the 11 of us went down the street. We had to have a police escort to do it.
Really?
To get permission. We had a patrol car in front of us and behind us. We went down about six blocks of Bourbon Street. By the time we got where we were going, there must have been 100 people following us.
Oh, my gosh.
And we took him into a bar. We got acquainted with the bartender, so we did him a favor. Brought everybody in his bar.
Yes, you did do him a favor, didn't you? That's wonderful.
Let's fly down or drive down to New Orleans. That city, well, it is so pretty. Historic scenes. I'll take you and parade you down old Bourbon Street. You'll see all the hot spots and meet all the big shots down in New Orleans.
Well, you know what? It said that you were the Minneapolis Aquatennial Jazz Band. You won something for them in 1972. There was a competition, apparently.
Yeah, they had a band competition in different categories, you know, rock and old-time and western. I think they had about six Dixieland bands. Doc Evans' band was in it.
Oh, gosh, sure.
But I think they had probably won it several times, and they weren't as fired up as we were, maybe. But anyway, we won that.
That had to be exciting.
Our saxophone player knew one of the three judges that probably didn't hurt either.
I love that you also were invited to play for some of the president's visits.
Well, that's right. When they came to Rochester area, we were the welcoming band for Nixon and Carter and George Bush, senior and junior, whatever you call them.
Yeah.
But the most interesting one was for Carter. He came to Wabasha. Well, he came on the Delta Queen. He booked passage on the Delta Queen for a week.
Did he?
The boat had been trying to get a president on there for years, and they finally got him to come on, and it was a publicity coup, both for the boat and for him. They bumped 100 passengers and gave him trips later. The front two big cabins, one was the White House, and the other was his bedroom. They had this whole press corps and everything. They bumped 100 people.
Oh, my goodness.
But when they stopped at Wabasha, we were in the shore band, and 10,000 people lined the shore.
Wow, pretty nice exposure there, Les. Les Fields, my guest here, talking about the Turkey River All-Stars and what a wonderful career he's had as well. We're talking about some of the highlights that he has had. You've done some work with Garrison Keillor?
Well, they had him come down and do a show at the Mayo Civic Auditorium once. They had a National Quit Smoking Day. He and Butch Thompson announced on his show that they were going to quit smoking.
You have taken the Turkey River All-Stars to several states for some of their jazz festivals, haven't you?
Yeah, I think we've played about 25 jazz fests, some of them more times than one. You know, first one we played was at the Big Spiderbeck Festival in Davenport.
One of them stand out in your mind? One of the jazz festivals?
Well, that probably that one. That was the biggest one and the first one. They get a lot of bands. That's a good one down there.
You don't necessarily find the Turkey River All-Stars doing club work. You do more private parties and concerts, it looks like.
One we did for 9 years every Tuesday at the Hoffman House in Rochester back in the 70s and 80s. Actually, the first 2 years were at the Keillor. The way this happened, they had hired a hotel consultant to advise them on everything, and he called me. He never heard the band. He says, we want to have a Dixieland band play once a week. You decide what time and what day. So we picked Tuesday, 5 till 7, I think it was, because I still wanted to be able to sell insurance after that. That lasted 2 years, but then they decided to make it into a disco. But we had such good crowds. I made a list of all the joints in town and decided Hoffman House looked the best because there was parking at the door. So we played there 7 more years.
You don't slow down. How often are you working now?
Oh, I'd say maybe 5 or 6 times a month. But there was a time for many years where we always had over 100 a year. I don't think I'd want to do that anymore.
You've gotten inducted into the Minnesota Music Hall of Fame. You've gotten great accolades playing for presidents. You have musicians that have been inducted into National Banjo Hall of Fame. You've done so many wonderful things, but you're not done yet. What do you still want to accomplish in your career, Les Fields?
Well, I should probably practice and learn some more tunes. Other than that, just keep playing as long as people keep calling.
All right, Les Fields, thank you so much. Thank you and goodbye, Les.
Thanks for having me, Patty.
Listening to the Minnesota jazz legends, the Elders. And now, jazz legend Irv Williams.
Right, welcome to the show, Irv Williams. So we're talking today about you and the fact that you're a jazz legend in our Twin Cities. You keep on working, playing, creating, recording. As I'm sitting here with you, there is sheet music on the table. Getting ready for another recording session,
yeah.
Right?
I've been playing professionally for at least 70 years.
70 years.
Yeah, professionally. Prior to that, I played the fiddle. My grandmother loved the violin, so she wanted me to play the fiddle, and she also wanted me to play the Indian flute, which she was an Indian, and so I used to play the Indian flute, in church. She had the large flute, and I had the little one, and so that's how I got into music. Okay. Well, I had 6, so that's all. You have to play everything. Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was raised between Cincinnati, Ohio, and Little Rock, Arkansas. My mother died when I was 3 or 4 years old, something like that, when she died in childbirth, and I was taken over by my grandmother. They told me this. My grandmother went in and looked at me and picked me up. She says, "This baby isn't dead. What are you people doing?" So she slapped me on the butt, and I started crying. Got a saxophone, and I kind of liked it. And it was a C melody I paid $10 for. So I was playing it up there. So I guess it's about time for me to get you a good horn, so he got me another used horn. It was an alto this time, because I was too small to play the tenor. Then I played clarinet also. So I knew from get-go that I was going to be a musician, but my dad was determined that I would go to medical school. I wasn't about to be a doctor, and I'd see how much time he spent with sick people and stuff like that, how tired he got. I took up the saxophone and the clarinet in junior high school, and I've been playing ever since. Mm-hmm. went to University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I tried to teach after I got the service. The substitute teacher here, but I just couldn't make it.
Were you able to be in music while you were in the service?
Right here.
Right
all
here?
All the time, yeah. We had a band here.
Navy Bandless.
Right in St. Paul.
In St. Paul, okay. And
we did all of the official band here. I didn't want to go here for nothing. I was in Pittsburgh playing at Crawford's Grill, and I was playing with Mary Lou Williams, and her husband at the time was a very good friend of mine. I got the gig. His name was Harold Baker, who's a member of the Duke Ellington Orchestra. And so I was working with them, and we were playing the Crawford Grill, which is a main street, the kind of black district, you know, and everything. And a couple of guys came up in blue suits and everything, and they showed me a badge and said, "Are you Harold Baker?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You got to get your butt back to St. Louis." He says, "You're going to be drafted." So then I came back to St. Louis. When I got there, there was a guy named Lynn Bowden who had joined the Navy for the purpose of entering guys as musicians in the Navy. They were cutting the Jim Crow out of the Navy, which was one of the most Jim Crow places you could find. Jim Crow is prejudice. How I got that way, I don't know, but that's the word. I was supposed to go to California, and the guy that was coming here, his name was Ballman. I didn't like him from the first get-go, you know. So I was trying to keep from him hearing me play, because he was scouting around for somebody to come up here. Well, I was, every time I'd see him, I'd go hide someplace. But he heard me play, and right away he says, "You're going up to Minnesota with me." I said, "Man, I don't want to go up, man. I said, ain't nothing up there, you know, nothing but snow and ice, you know." He says, "Well, you going to go?" I said, what about the Navy promised me that I could go to California, you know? He says, "Well, I need somebody to go up there. I don't care about California." So that's how I got up here. I'd been married, and I had one kid that I hadn't seen because I was overseas at the time the kid was born. So I came back here, and right away I got a letter. He's a friend of mine, and he said that they had an opening in Billy Eckstein's band. So I, Billy was playing in a ballroom that used to be a white ballroom, and blacks were moving out into St. Louis. So it was a black nightclub, beautiful nightclub there. So Billy was playing there. He came up to me and he says, "Are you out of the Navy?" I said, "No, because I had just gotten out that day." He says, "Well, this is in the 50s.
All right.
Yeah. But I had to stay here with my wife and my kid and everything, so I stayed here. Then I got a gig at Central High School substitute teaching, and I hated that. I didn't like it at all. So I went to the union. So I got in, and no work. There was the Urban League. And so I had all these members of the band that had come in, and we call ourselves the ex-Navy Band.
Okay.
So we're all together, and we were playing over in Ralston over there on Saturdays and stuff like that. And we got all together. So I went down to that club called Brass Rail, I think, it's mm-hmm. something like that.
Yes.
And we did an audition. He liked us, and so he said, "But he says I have to either hire black or white, but I can't have it mixed." I said, "What the hell's the matter with you, man?" I said, "This is the 25th century, as far as you're concerned. You know, what are you talking about?" You know? So he said, "Well, I don't want to say anymore." He says, "But I can't use you right now." So I went to the Urban League, and so I Frank Wardlow was his name. So I told him what happened. He said, "You hit the ceiling." So we went to Sam Schreiner, Anti-Defamation League.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you a huge advocate for musicians in the workforce?
Why, sure. I sure was. I wouldn't work below scale or anything like that. And I'm not a union kind of go-to-meeting kind of guy, you know, but I support the union 100%. I was working with the George Hudson Band in St. Louis, and he had a contract to accompany Ella on a tour. And you know how long the tour lasted? All during the war. Clark Terry and a heck of a band. That was a hard thing to do because Clark Terry and I went together and he managed to get out. But see, he got a blue discharge.
Oh.
And that goes with you all your life. Yeah, I got honorable discharge, you know. I always found a spot and sat down. I didn't have to. Somebody would hire me and I'd sit down and stay and play. I was at a place that they had called Sherwood Forest in St. Paul. I was there at that place for at least 3 years.
We're talking St. Paul again. Did you have a mainstay in Minneapolis as well?
Oh, yeah, the Cassius Bamboo Room, not downtown Minneapolis on 3rd Street. But he had a joint on 38th and 4th Avenue. And so we applied. He was the first black guy that got a liquor license. So when I came back from X-Town, I was with Billy about the first time I was with him for 3 months. The second time I was with him for almost a year. You know, I worked two jobs. I was up to Hilton from 62.
Who was working with you there?
Billy Wallace was the original guy up there at the top of the Hilton. But he left and I was working with him, so he turned the gig over to me. And so I was just as happy, you know, because I knew I could make a good deal out of it. So I stayed there for 8-9 years at least.
Oh, wow.
I was working days. I was in a dry cleaning business. I was killing myself. So when the gig ended up there, I worked. Right after that, I went up just a block away from where they were working. But I was there for 2 or 3 years. We had Reginald. Reginald was working with me there when he died.
Really?
Yeah.
You did some work at the University of Minnesota, too, with Reginald, didn't
Quite
you?
Quite a bit. He had me listen to them and make recommendations and things, because I'm a firm believer in scales. Before you start trying to name chords, just learn these scales.
Did you receive awards in your day?
I was the first one to get the Jazz Masters Award. I've had so many highlights. I guess my greatest highlight was turning down Duke Ellington. Harold Baker, a good friend of mine in Duke's band, Johnny Hodges, they were at the STEM Hall, I think it was, playing there. And so I went down to see them. This was right after the war. And they all was pointing and everything. So when they got off the stand, they all came down, come on, we're gonna see Duke. I said, for what? Said, we're gonna get you in the band. I said, no. Why? Why don't you? You'd be a great addition to this band. I said, man, I'm so scared right now. I just could not do it. So I turned it down. I stayed here and I made a life for myself.
Irv Williams, how old will you be on your next birthday?
95.
95 years old.
95, yeah.
I'm your host, Patty Peterson, and you're listening to the Minnesota Jazz Legends, The Elders.